Donegal has some of the most beautiful gardens in the country and a rich tradition of garden making that stretches back to monastic times and spans the county from the Fanad Peninsula to Donegal Bay. But these gardens are much more than beautiful spaces. Behind neat hedges and through the flower borders hide 100 stories of our history, our garden making, and the magnificent obsessions that inspire people to make and maintain these Edens. My name is Mary Brophy, and I'm once again heading down the garden path to explore 6 more of Donegal's best-loved gardens. From a farmed landscape to private havens, in this second series, I'll be considering what it means to garden in a time of climate crisis and biodiversity loss.
You could actually smell the burning last year. I thought the geraniums would never come back again, you know, but they did.
And experience the stunning plants and trees that inhabit these spaces.
These are Scheffleras, so these are native to Taiwan. They're relatively new on the scene.
As I discover how we can create beautiful, productive spaces that work for both wildlife and people.
We have such little problems with pests. There is a balance. It's not a monoculture.
And how we might evolve our definition of what a garden is or can become.
Gardens can be absolutely anything your imagination wants them to be.
In today's episode, I've come to see a garden outside Lifford to learn about its ties to an Irishman who revolutionised English gardening in the 19th century, creating what we now know as the quintessential cottage garden, and learn how many of his ideas take on a new resonance in our time.
He was really revolutionary in that he did away with borders and formal settings.
This is Belinda Mahaffey. We're in the very lovely garden created by Belinda's mother, Mrs. Jessie Mahaffey. And I'm here to explore the connections in this garden to one of the most influential gardeners of the 19th century, William Robinson.
He had a huge impact on life today for people all over the world. And we've no idea, really, you know, we're doing something which William Robinson might have approved of.
But first, I want to get a feel for this garden and its origins.
This is the remains of a quarry. They took out stones for flag floors last century. And so it's all shale. So as I said, the house was rented out for about 30 years. So when we moved here, my mother just used leaves and wood ash for beds. And she got rid of lots of brambles and things that were there. And look at this. You can see that still be there. Do you see how pinched it is?
Belinda's garden has been suffering somewhat.
And no amount of watering or mulching seems to be improving anything.
Ireland's warming trend continued in 2022. Spring and summer were drier than average in Ireland. And at the time Belinda and I recorded last summer, there hadn't been any significant rainfall here for a few weeks.
No, well, we've had a month here almost without rain. And then, of course, when you have those high temperatures.
Was this a little drain,
and it's been almost dried up this year. As you can see, there's a lot of vegetation growing along the edge. And even here, you know, there's gaps. Normally all the plants would be filling out. And it's, no matter what you do, I've mulched all that there. It just doesn't seem to be happening.
One part of the garden, though, is at least coping with these conditions.
This is the bit here I call the cottagey garden. Actually, that seems to have survived best. And the rest of the garden could have been equally as colourful, you know, with geraniums and things.
And you have beautiful geraniums here spilling out onto the path. And we have the heart's tongue fern just at the edge.
Yes.
Lovely little spikes there. And but talk to me about some of the plants in here. It's quite idyllic and a lovely drift of it going back up towards the house.
Yes, well, you have a red hot poker, which has just appeared. You have, as you say, the beautiful blue geraniums tumbling out. Yellow Lysimachia. Again, quite colourful stilbe here. You have pinks and there's a fiery red. And we have Monbrecia down at the end. The hostas here they have survived much better. Slugs haven't really affected them.
And a lovely, almost pale lilac colour on the hosta flower.
Yes.
Which is...
And these were the candelabra primroses. This rose is actually my great aunt's rose, and it had lovely flowers. I mean, she must have planted it about 1900. It's amazing how long plants live. I'm fascinated by the age of plants. Who would believe a rose could be, well, over 100 years old?
Yes.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And it's a lovely story that adds to the house as
yes.
well, that you know that that has been part of the house as long as the building.
Exactly.
You know?
That rockery, the rackwoodesias, you know, the columbines.
Yes.
And I never gather the seed. Same with the foxgloves, which are growing over here. I just let them seed. You find they're happiest wherever these want to seed. This period, you see, it's not very large.
Yes.
And there's a little bit of everything in it. You can see
from one cottage garden, we've come inside the house to another.
Lovely herbs and maybe gooseberry bushes or currant bushes.
Mm, yeah.
And it's very unplanned, unstructured.
And on another wall, Belinda shows me a photograph.
My grandmother, my mother's mother, was William's second cousin. This is the lady here. She was actually called Jenny Robinson. And her grandmother, let's see now. Her grandmother was Sarah Robinson, who was William's aunt. And when William's father ran away, as Robinson then did, to the California Gold Rush, she and her husband paid for William's education and looked after his family.
In the April 1921 census of England, a William Robinson, then aged 82 and residing at Gravetye Manor House in Sussex, is listed with his place of birth as Queen's County, Ireland, now County Laois. Not much is known for certain about his early years, but he was born in July 1838, 1 year into Victoria's reign, and into a time of rapid change and development across England and Ireland. His gardening career is said to have begun in Waterford, at the private estate of Kerrmore House.
When he worked in Waterford at the age of 15, one of his jobs was to carry buckets of water from the river to the glass houses to water the annuals. And he was a red-haired man with a fiery temper, apparently, and this evoked a great hatred in him towards bedding plants and formality.
From Waterford, William returned to Laois, to the gardens of Ballycalcavan near Stradbally. He worked as garden foreman until sometime in late 1861, when, as a now infamous story would have us believe, he had a row with his employer and, in spite, let the fires out in the glasshouses to kill off a prized collection of tropical plants. But a less dramatic account would suggest his Aunt Sarah stoked his ambitions and advised him to move on. At any rate, Robinson left for England and in early 1862 secured a position at the Royal Botanic Society's garden in Regent's Park. Here he began to develop his knowledge of wildflowers and plants in their native habitat. The ambitious 24-year-old was also beginning to develop his contacts, moving within a very influential circle. He started writing and publishing articles on his research. In 1866, he was elected to the Linnaean Society, nominated by Charles Darwin. And in that year, Robinson resigned from Regent's Park to devote himself to his writing.
Also, he went to the exhibition in France. He wrote for the newspapers and journals there for about a year about the different exhibitions of different plants. And this sort of gave him a feeling for having plants in a natural landscape. He also went plant hunting in the Alps, in the Welsh hills, and in Greece and Egypt. So so this is probably what gave him his ideas.
Like, he then began to develop this vision, I suppose, of gardens that would be created out of
locally adapted winter hardy plants.
Yes.
Wasn't it?
He did. There was a burgeoning middle class, and when he went on these plant hunting expeditions, he brought new plants back to Veitch, who propagated them and sold them to the burgeoning middle class. And I mean, they were sort of wealthy, very wealthy Victorians, and they wanted new houses and wonderful gardens.
And it was into this fertile ground of a new and wealthy Victorian middle class that William Robinson began to sow the seeds of his radical ideas.
Beyond this, we have some wild cherry, which also disappears very quickly. The birds love it. My mother loved ferns, and she has them planted all over the garden.
This is Down the Garden Path, and in today's episode, I'm at Mrs. Jessie Mahaffey's garden in Blackrock, as current owner Belinda Mahaffey shows me around. I'm here to trace the influences of Belinda's famous cousin, William Robinson, on this garden's DNA, and to learn more about the Irishman who radically changed Victorian gardens.
But just here under, you've obviously pruned the...
The shape, yes.
Just to create a lovely little archway as we walk down under the path.
Well, I was reading a bit about Japanese and Chinese gardening, and the Chinese used to deliberately curve trees. It was meant to welcome you.
Lovely.
They called it a welcome tree, but usually it was the entrance to their garden, so you'd have to stand on the side
to get that
to entrance. Get back in. If you come in, actually, okay. It's quite a nice view looking up.
That is lovely.
Isn't it?
And we see the seating area and then all of this beautiful planting to the left now.
Talk to me about the book, The Wild Garden.
Yes, well, he'd written a few other books before that, and the Wild Garden is just one of his aspects of his vision of gardening, where you combine wild plants with garden plants to form a vista. And you utilise, well, for boggy areas, obviously, you put in plants that like that area. He was thinking on an ecological basis, where you have plants and animals that just live in certain strata. Mm-hmm. And he was adding these into his garden mix.
The Wild Garden was first published in 1870, when Robinson was just 32. The ideas and gardening style contained within its pages are so familiar to us today that it's difficult to comprehend just how radical these ideas were to a British public in the 19th century. Essentially, he was suggesting that gardeners do away with formality and railed against what he described as the tyranny of bedding. Robinson advocated planting hardy perennials in drifts where they were happy. By mixing native and exotic plants, planting swathes of bulbs in grasses, and a subtle use of colour, the gardener could achieve a more naturalistic or wild garden.
Well, he was revolutionary, actually. This is why we are still gardening according to his ideas more than 100 years later, because everything was just a turnaround from gardens. As we'd known them over the centuries, even from Roman times, gardens were laid out in a certain manner. And this was just an incredible mixture of... it reflected maybe the social order changing in the world. Up to Robinson's time, the world was just one way, and that was it.
Ordered.
As Cecil Francis Alexander wrote in All Things Bright and Beautiful, what was it? It's frowned upon today, the rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate. So,
but Robinson's genius lies equally in his publishing career, because it was this that allowed him to disseminate his ideas to the widest market. In 1871, Robinson launched his first weekly journal, The Garden, and served as its editor for nearly 30 years.
He actually had several magazines, Homes and Gardens Illustrated, which is still there today.
Yes.
He founded and he employed Gertrude Jekyll as an editor. He also sold books on gardening for about 50 different people. He was the first person to use colour prints in magazines anywhere in the world.
that vision that he had, that idea of combining aesthetic and sustainable management and, yes. and, you know, and the types of plants that would work in a garden, it strikes me as having huge relevance today, doesn't it? Like, it's come almost full circle again.
It's all about ecology, basically. And as I said, he studied the works of the first ecological scientist, who was a German named Ernst Haeckel. He actually formulated the science of ecology in 1866, and it deals with the study of habitats and ecosystems.
And Robinson had studied him?
Yes. Yeah. He was in a Victorian world that was just changing rapidly and discovering new things and experimenting. You see, Robinson was also a member of the Linnaean Society. He was made a fellow when he was quite young. And so he would have been in touch with all of these scientific minds. So you have a combination of science and art. Come with me. I have a little orchard up here. There are lots of elder trees up here. I make a cordial in the summer when I have time.
So we've just come out at the back and we're completely open into sunshine again.
Yes.
After coming out from under the trees.
These are my autumn raspberries.
Lovely.
This is the first year I've had real fruit on the apple trees. They're miniatures, so
they're the perfect height
pleased.
For you and I, Belinda.
Yes.
It's lovely. Just at arms, well, our arms reach.
I cut the top off them. And, I still have to work on briars there over the winter with some briars. You can see all these elder trees here. So it's really from the point of biodiversity, the birds have a great feast.
Absolutely.
This keeps them going September, October.
And November. They have all the shelter here for the trees behind.
Lots of nourishment. And then there's a rookery and a jackdaw. Now, this is an example of wild gardening here. Here we have a Cotone aster, well, with tropeolium growing through it. And do you see the tropeolium is just going over, and the seedlings are turning from yellow into these little blue berries.
Very pretty.
And behind it, I have a wall of willow herb, which actually complemented the colour of the geraniums over there, which should all have been alive and blooming at this time of the year.
I mean, that willow herb
is
would
a wild
be.
Flower.
And it would be seen all across the roadsides at the moment as
yes,
a weed.
Yes.
It's so pretty.
It is, exactly. So I have a clump of it. Yes, you see it there?
Yes.
And, yeah.
You can see exactly what you were talking about now. It's picking up the beautiful little pink geranium here at the base of
yes.
the Tony Aster.
And that rockery was full of that pink geranium as well, which is just...
Echoing the berries here on top of the Cotone Aster.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Lovely. So you deliberately planted the willow herb there?
I noticed it. And then I encouraged it.
William Robinson encouraged gardeners to reconsider their role in the garden. He defined wild gardening, in essence, as placing plants where they will thrive without further care. Ideas that seem so modern now, like no-mow May, daffodils sown to naturalise in a lawn, willow herb among geraniums, all stem from Robinson's enduring message that there is beauty, diversity, and a lot less work to be found in a garden where plants are given freedom.
There's a butterfly, spotted wood. I've only seen one peacock blue this year, about June, and normally they're about at this time of the year in the buddleia.
Yes.
And they're not on the buddleia.
As conditions change, as warming or rainfall or new diseases make our gardens more unpredictable, gardeners once again find themselves thinking about how these spaces can thrive. It's certainly on Belinda's mind these days.
And there was only one swallow there that used to nest in her shed until last year. And I know the temperatures in the Sahara were about 40 and 50 degrees. So I'd imagine the poor birds couldn't get up here, you know.
So you don't have swallows this year?
I saw just one resting there, and I've seen them feeding around here, but they don't seem to be in such numbers. Which
is that the first time in?
First time I've noticed that.
That there's no swallow nesting here?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
It's worrying.
It's worrying you, but what do you feel? Is that something you've been thinking about in terms of gardening in general?
Well,
how we're going to
cope with it? Well, can we go back down there and
yes.
show you? We have a mini meadow here, which my mother started, and I enlarged a little bit on the gravel. And I found last year during the drought, I didn't have to water it, or that bed there, which is July and August, plants mainly with one yellow witch hazel growing up through it. And
this is this bed here in front of us. We're in the centre of the courtyard, if you like, around the buildings.
And it's got mint and different geraniums. And this is, you know, foxes and cubs.
Yes.
That may be the way to garden in the future.
Right.
Just gravel beds.
Yeah.
With, you know, moisture underneath. You see, the gravel prevents the moisture from evaporating. So that may be the way. But what happens in the meantime to your azaleas and your rhododendrons and all those things that get scorched when the temperatures are so high? Do they just disappear out of the gardens?
It's, are you hopeful, though?
Pessimistic. I don't see any room for optimism because I don't think people are doing enough about it. Individuals are trying. People are probably more aware of it now, and a lot of people think it's just politics or old hat. And I think even a lot of the politicians don't really know what they're talking about properly. And they say, well, plant trees and we have greenways. But will that fix everything? Who knows? Maybe the scientists will come up with something.
This garden is open in the spring. Its title is Mrs. Jessie Mahaffey's Garden.
Which it is.
Which it is. But are you feeling now in retirement that you have time? Is it now becoming
Mahaffey's Garden? She started it, and when she was about 88, members of the garden trail asked her to open. And she was thrilled at being asked, but she was really angry because she felt she was too old to do it properly. So the first year she died when she was 90, I opened it as a tribute to her. And I enjoyed it so much. And it's one way of keeping the garden up to date, because when you have nobody coming, they say, oh, I'll do that next week. And so
next week becomes next year.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's how I joined the garden trail. So I've moved it around. I was open in June, and I think now maybe the spring with the daffodils and everything.
Yeah.
But it's sort of a garden in two halves. What do you do with the beds then at that time of the year? Mm. You know, there's nothing to see there, and people might say, oh, half of the things are dead, you know.
Our expectations, I think that's become the theme of our conversation today, Belinda. Our expectations of gardens are going to have to change.
Yes. Exactly.
And our expectations of gardeners at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah.
So next year I might go for an early spring opening.
Yes.
Just mulch the beds and say, well, you know, they're not ready.
You said to me you're pessimistic, but I think, like most gardeners, there is a degree of constantly looking towards the future.
Yes.
And next spring. I think that will continue in this garden too.
Well, one gardener said to me a few years ago, in spite of everything that happens, he said, the sun always rises in the morning and sets at night. So you have to think of that too. I actually had a privilege once. I saw swallows leaving. I was in a field nearby picking blackberries and very overgrown hedges. And all the birds were singing very loudly in September. And I thought, that's very strange, you know, for this time of year. And the singing got louder and louder. And I looked up, and there were 9 swallows flying in a circle above me. And they gradually went into a corkscrew. And they went higher and higher until I could no longer see them. And as they went up in the air, the songbirds all got louder and louder. It was as if they were saying goodbye to them.
Next time on Down the Garden Path.
The blackbird is so bold. I mean, when he knows if there is something tasty in here, he brings all his friends as well, and then it will be full of blackbirds in here.
Down the Garden Path is written and presented by Mary Brophy and produced by Neil Boyle. It is an IWR media production for Highland Radio, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.